very welcome on today's programme. A house in the Phoenix Park and rent that never increased despite record rental inflation. We asked Minister of State at the Department of Justice, Niall Collins, for further detail on the accommodation arrangement that was put in place for the former Gorthe Commissioner, Drew Harris. More than 5,000 children homeless for Christmas. Is it now time for the government to set targets to reduce homelessness? And has the focus on crime in Dublin and cities left swathes of rural Ireland vulnerable to crime? What do you do if you're a victim of crime in rural Ireland? Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. Please get in touch right throughout the programme. You can text 51551, you can WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32, and you can email us at saturday@rte.ie. I'll introduce my panel in a few moments, but we're going to begin today with a story that many of you may be familiar with. It's the tragic story of pensioner John Mackey, who was beaten to death in cold blood while walking home with his shopping in North London last summer. John was 87 years old and was originally from Callan in County Kilkenny. His attacker, Peter Augustine, was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 23 years after a 9-day trial at the Old Bailey yesterday. And reading about this trial and listening about this trial in the last over the last number of days and since the brutal attack occurred, it has resonated with an awful lot of people in Ireland, because it could have been any one of our relatives who had immigrated to London or anywhere in the UK over the last many years. John's niece, Pat Shan, gave the victim impact statement on behalf of the family, and she joins me now. Pat, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, hello.
You're extremely welcome. And can I just convey my condolences for your loss at the outset?
Thank you. And, thank you very much.
And I know yesterday must have been extremely difficult for you all.
It was indeed, yes, it was. But it did feel like a you know, closure, at like the end of the saga. So,
can I ask you about John first and foremost? Because he was much loved, I know, from the coverage. He was described as a perfect uncle, Pat.
Well, he was, because he never married. He was a real ladies' man and always said that he didn't want the responsibility. But there's 22 of us, 22 nieces and nephews, and he was the perfect uncle, because he was, you know, he was always on our side. He was a real ally to all of us, you know, and always up to mischief, and he was always like slipping us a fiver. And he still did that even when... you know, when I used to see him in the last few years, as he'd walk me to the tube, he'd slip me a fiver, you know, even though I'm in my 60s.
Yeah, so, I know that as well. The generosity of the older pensioner, let's say, and it never leaves him.
Yeah.
Can you bring me back, though, Pat, to that really horrific day when you learned of the brutal attack?
Well, it was awful. It was absolutely awful, because John and my cousin Stephen are the only two relatives actually living in London. We've got a few on the outskirts. I'm down on the south coast and we're kind of spread around England. And I got a call to say from Stephen to say he was in A&E with Uncle John. And I thought he'd had a fall, because he'd had a couple of falls in the recent months beforehand. And then next thing I knew, I was talking to a policeman. And he was just telling me about what had happened, and it was just unbelievable. Yeah. I just couldn't get over it.
And but he suffered for 2 days, though, didn't he, before he passed away?
He did. He regained consciousness briefly at the scene and asked where his bag was. Then he started to kind of slip into unconsciousness. And then when I was speaking to the policeman, they got the neurosurgeon, the doctor, to come and speak to me, and you know, and he kind of explained that the situation was grave. They'd already scanned him. I think it was about 9:30 when I talked to them, and they'd already done a brain scan to show the extent of the damage. He had three big areas of bleeding in his brain, and they explained that you know, that the bleeding was continuing, so he would just continue to deteriorate. So he was unconscious by that point, and stayed unconscious till he died on Thursday evening.
It was a death that he simply did not deserve, based on what I've heard, and the amount of love that all of you had for him as well, and the amount of joy and mischief, as you say, that he gave to your family.
Full of mischief. Yeah.
Um, The attack was particularly heinous, wasn't it?
Oh, desperate. I mean, you know, watching the CCTV, the first day we went to court, our family liaison officer from the Met said, we want to see it before, because he didn't want us to see it cold in court. So we sat down in the Old Bailey in the family room and watched this, just this man, this cold-blooded man, just watching Uncle John and following him. Because you see on the CCTV, I mean, the officer who picked him up on the CCTV can only be thanked so much, but because she spotted him, and you saw him watching Uncle John. Uncle John was in the chip shop at Manor House getting his bits and pieces. Well, he went, no, first went to the co-op, got his little bit of shopping, and then he went to the chip shop. And then you can see him outside watching in the window to see what he's done. And then he's followed him all the way around. Uncle John lived on quite a modern estate, yeah, and there was all sort of landscaping, and he's followed him into the one little area, which literally you could see Uncle John's flat from it, where there were some bushes and what have you, and that's where he attacked him.
My goodness. So it was calculated and really harrowing as well. I watched the arrest of Peter Augustine, the killer, this morning, and he's shouting at police. And it struck me when I was reading about the trial, Pat, that you had to endure as a family, that there were outbursts from him then as well.
Oh, well, we were in court every day. I mean, I was in court every day. My brother was in court every day. And then we had, there was three or four of us of the others as well. So there was always five or six of his nieces and nephews in court. But it was very, very difficult, and my daughter as well. But it was very, very difficult because it was a very small courtroom. I mean, I've never been in a courtroom in my life, you know. And he was, you know, he kept shouting at us, you know, which was quite scary. It was scary. And when he was in the witness stand, he was literally a stone's throw from us, and that was really intimidating. And the last
day, what was he shouting?
Just he didn't do it. How, you know, he would never do something like that. You know, but he lost his temper numerous times during the proceedings. I mean, he was taken down to the cells three or four times. The judge wouldn't put up with it. But the worst was that on the Wednesday he started, when our barrister, Jane Bickerstaff, started cross-examining him, he lost his rag completely. And you could see that the man was just no control of his temper at all, which is obviously what happened. And I had a terrible moment where he was leaning out of the witness stand, roaring at our barrister. And I just had this vision that that was the last thing Uncle John saw.
Yeah.
It broke my heart completely. It really did.
Yeah. I understand that, actually, and I can understand how traumatic that would be.
It's a despicable individual. Yeah.
If there's any solace in any of that, in experiencing any of that, Pat, it probably helped the prosecution.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, he sold himself. I mean, you know, I mean, even when his defence lawyer, who had the worst job in the world, he was roaring at her. I mean, you know, she started to try and ask him a question, and he would just start shouting. And she would say to him, you know, let me ask you a question. I'm trying to help you, you know.
And can I ask about Stephen in particular? Because I know this was particularly triggering for Stephen and traumatic because unbelievably, really, and I just couldn't get over this when I read it. He was, I think, if I dare say so, closest to John, maybe, of the family. It was triggering for him because of his own experience in London.
Of course, because Stephen was one of three boys of my Uncle Christy, John's brother, and he was attacked in the street in the late 90s when he was a very young man and left for dead. And he was in a coma for weeks and weeks and recovered, but it's left him with lifelong disability and brain injury symptoms. And and Uncle Christy is now passed before lockdown, and the mother was gone and the brothers are gone. So Stephen and John were the only two in London. And so they were friends as well as anything else. And and it had a terrible effect on him because, of course, he went to the hospital. He was called to the A&E and realised really quickly, oh, my God, this is exactly what happened to me. And, of course, he was at the bedside while we were all trying to get organised to come to London. And, it was so triggering for him. And in court it was awful because they kept talking about you know, the trauma and the stamping on his head and all of that sort of thing. So there was a couple of days that Stephen just couldn't come to court. It affected his mental health so badly.
My goodness, the poor man.
Desperate, really desperate.
But it falls to you, Pat, then, to go to court and read out the victim impact statement or how it's impacted the family. How difficult was that?
It was very difficult, but I was very determined because I'm the eldest of the 22 nieces and nephews, so I'm kind of, by default, the matriarch, I think. And because my mother was one of the eldest of John's brothers and sisters. It was very, very difficult, but I was very determined to do it because I just wanted a voice from the family, not like a legal person or a policeman or something like that. And I just wanted them to hear, you know, what John was about and, just to hear about him as a person. I didn't want that end to define him, and I was really determined about that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just about, and the impact on the family, you know, like John's older brother, Tommy, he's 89, he's 90 in February and at home in Callan. And he's up at the grave every day. He just, every day, my cousin Magella has to explain to him what's happened, you know, and he keeps still asking, was it true and everything, and goes up to the grave every day.
So John is buried in Callan?
He's buried in Callan. Oh, yeah. He always wanted to go home. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he always wanted, that was never any doubt. He bought his plot and we discussed it many times, as we usually do, graves at home. And so that was all done. But it was things like, you know, we weren't able to get him home until mid-June. He died on the 8th of May. And, of course, just again explaining to Uncle Tommy why he wasn't home. You know, this it's all part of a big trauma, you know, a big family trauma. But we had a massive, I mean, the funeral was fantastic. You know, there were so many people turned out because even though he's been in London for 70 years, you know, there were still a lot of people and the family is still there and we all go home every year for the mass and everything.
Well, can I say to you, I think you've done a particularly good job, if I may say so, at maintaining the loving image you all had of John Mackey for the public as well, because we know him now as the perfect uncle and as the loving uncle and as a charismatic, mischievous man. Yeah. But it resonates with me, I think, this longing of the immigrants to return home and to be buried in your home place.
Never any discussion. Yeah. Never any discussion.
My God. Well, look at Pat. I so much appreciate you talking to us. My condolences to you all. Lots of love from this side of the Irish Sea. Pat Shan, niece of John Mackey. Thank you very much indeed.